You're listening to The Wicked Horror Show, powered by the Dorkening Podcast Network. For more information, check out thedorkening.com.
This episode of Wicked Horror Show was broadcast live to Facebook. In this episode, we're talking to director and actor Garo Nagosian. We're talking to Garo about his movie Dangerous People. This was brought to our attention by Phil from Dark Discussions, another awesome podcast that you should go check out. This is a real interesting one. It's a good thriller, and it's set in the 70s. And you know, we talked to Garo about maybe some of the hurdles he had to go through making the movie. You know, low-budget films are always a little difficult to make. It's definitely a very interesting movie. And as always, if you like what you hear, head over to facebook.com/thedorkening every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for a live show just like this one, where you can interact with the guests, interact with us. You know, we're guests too, I guess. I don't know. And also head over to thedorkening.com to check out all the other shows on the Dorkening Podcast Network. We have awesome shows by some awesome people. Go check them out. But first, enjoy the show.
Okay, here we are, and so the normal group is here. Kevin.
What's up?
Wolfman.
Oh!
So loud. It's so loud.
I know.
There's no reason for it to be that loud.
Oh, yo, yo.
Hey, everybody.
Tony.
What is going on, people?
CP.
Hi.
And our very, very special guest of the evening, writer, director of Dangerous People, Garo Nagosian, thank you, sir, for joining us.
Hey, how you doing? Happy to be here.
Congratulations, Leo. I'm pronouncing special, but that's okay. So, Garo, we met at ScareCon, New England this past. I think it was September, maybe August.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I can't remember. Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to. There was a screening of your movie Dangerous People. And I was able to see most of it. I didn't get to finish it because I had a panel that I was moderating. So I had to leave. But what I saw, I really dug. And the first person I thought of when I saw what I saw was Wolfie. Because Wolfie likes classic cars. He likes horror. He likes gore. And I was like, I wonder if Wolfie would dig this. And I actually mentioned it to him back then. And I think you sent me a screener back then, and I want to say I forwarded it on to Wolfie, and I think it got mixed in the shuffle, but I'm glad that we were finally able to get you on. I think his name is Phil, right? From Dark Discussions.
Yes.
He's the one who referred me to your movie, and thank you very much, Phil. And I'm glad that we were able to check it out. So, I'm glad I got to see the whole thing finally. And I just want to go around the room maybe and ask everyone what they thought of the movie. Real quick. So, Wolfie, I know you already talked to him a little bit on the sit down, but just give, you know, maybe some quick thoughts on the movie.
I actually, as I said to him, this reminded me a lot of the back in the mid 80s when the video explosion happened, that people just were grabbing all the video cameras they could and just making, you know, shot on video movies. And that's kind of, I know it takes place in the 70s, but that's the feel I got for the movie. But there were a few scenes, and in the movie that, I mean, I liked it, but I'm just saying there was like one scene that reminded me a lot of Easy Rider. He's tripping out. Vince is tripping out the first time. And there's a scene where it just feels a lot like the cemetery scene in Easy Rider. So I dug that. I really dug the soundtrack of this movie.
Yeah. I thought you would. Actually, that's one of the music in the cars. I'm like, I gotta
that classic Camaro, that classic Chevelle. Just loved them both. Yeah.
So you dug it. That's cool.
Yeah.
I know CP, you didn't get to see the whole movie. You saw the trailer, but what did you think from the trailer?
I'm captivated. I'm a little frustrated. See, I should have tried. My schedule's been a little funky. I meant to do something about it, but it was today, and it was too late. So. I'm intrigued. It's not like other things that I've watched where I've watched the trailer and said,
right. Yeah. It has a different vibe. Like I agree with Wolfie where it kind of makes you feel like almost you know, an independent movie from like the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of had that vibe, which isn't a bad thing at all, in my opinion.
No.
That was when some of my favorite movies were made. So, yeah. So, Yo-Yo, what did you think?
Yeah, it definitely had a very independent vibe. I loved, 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 loved the music.
And that's all original like, music too, right? That's not, that was that written for, well, not written for the movie, but that's like a newer artist, right?
No. J.D. Blackfoot is, that's an actual music from his 1972 album called The Ultimate Prophecy. It's from his, that album and the B-sides. Yeah, so it was, I found that music. What happened was, when I was rewriting the script before we started shooting, I had a playlist on Pandora, like a psychedelic rock playlist. And that song came up for called Wondering Where You Are, which is a song that you hear when Zeus and Zoltan walk into the bar and see Erica for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I heard that song and I'm like, wow, that song would be perfect for that scene. And then I'm like, I found out what the album was, who the artist was, J.D. Blackfoot, looked up, downloaded the album and the B-sides and all that. And I listened to him. I'm like, oh, this song would be great there. This song would be great there. And then I just hunted him down and worked out a deal with him for the music for the movie. Uh-huh. And the score was my friend Bren. He did a lot of the score. And then another was a band in Florida called Palm Tree Lumberjacks. And they did some of the score too.
Okay. Yeah, for some reason, I don't know why, but I guess it was just a miscommunication. Like when I met you, I thought that it was a newer band that sounded 70s. And I've always been kind of jealous, you know, when there's some bands that can replicate that sound, because it's actually not easy to do nowadays because of the quality of the instrument and the quality of recording.
Well, but,
it sounded great.
I didn't want to do the movie if I didn't have real 70s music in the movie. And, you know, when you're dealing with a movie that has a very small budget like this movie did, you're kind of like, how the fuck am I going to get, you know, the real 70s music? But this kind of happened. It was kind of like a gift given to me from up above that I don't know how it happened, but it fell into my lap and I was smart enough to take advantage of it. And I was able to get this really amazing music for the movie.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pandora.
Thank you.
And it fits completely. It totally fits with the vibe of the movie. And I don't know. I couldn't imagine anything else, to be honest with you.
I know.
Yeah.
Me neither.
Yeah. So Tony, what did you think of the movie?
Well, you guys pretty much, you know, stated most of it, like my thoughts. But the I'm going to say one of the major things that I did like is the amount of nudity in it. I must say that nude girls definitely helps out. So like I said, you pretty much mentioned it, the music. That's the thing that kind of, especially when it fits. Sometimes there's good music in a movie and it just doesn't go with the movie. It's like, okay, I like the songs, but it doesn't go with. So that fit together. And then just the right in the beginning, I was like, it must be, you know, I didn't read the IMDb or anything, but I'm like, it must be a little later or like earlier because they walk into the bar and they try to pick up the girl. I'm like, that would not work in present time whatsoever, trying to do, hey, let's make a movie or something like that. I'm like, I'm guessing it's, and then I read the IMDb, but overall, I definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah. And I know Leo is not a big horror guy, like not as big as some of us, but
people, we're doing Scorsese gore, where it's kind of like quick, you know, you see it, boom, it's there, and then it's gone. It's not like you're going to linger on it or anything like that.
But in
but still, like what he was going for, I think it totally.
I know he's going for subtle.
Yeah. And you know, the gore that's there is effective, definitely.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's just like, oh, geez, that happened. But then you don't, yeah, like you said, you're not lingering on it. And one thing I just wanted to touch on what Tony said with the nudity. So the one thing that I've you know, I'm sure a lot of us had noticed in a lot of independent horror movies is a lot of times when there's nudity, it's, you know, not saying all the time, but there's an actress who, you know, would be willing to take her clothes off and they may not be the best actor or actress in the world. Right. I thought that the female, and I forget her name, but the female lead that was in the movie, I thought she was fantastic. Like, she was acting, her acting was on
point. Yeah.
Just great. It was on point the whole time. So I think, I mean, that's something that you don't see very often especially in like a lower budget that includes that kind of nudity and stuff. So where did you find her?
Well, she's a Playboy model. Her name's Angelina Lay. And she's done like a bunch of like movies. Like she was in a bunch of a couple of the, what's his name? The guy from upstate New York. What's his name? The guy who makes I can't remember his name. Beelzebub. She'd been in a few Beelzebub movies. And she'd been in like one of those like low budget Krampus movies or something. And like she'd been in some stuff, but most of what she was given was get naked, get murdered. You know? And when she read my script, she was like, oh my God, I never get offered anything that's this good. And she was on board from the minute she read the script because she didn't get offers for movies like this. So basically we ended up, cast these people in the movie, you talk a lot about the movie and the characters and stuff like that. And you also talk about tone, and it's all about getting the tone right. And you have to make sure that, because the one thing I have to say about a movie that's like this grisly, I wanted to have like a kind of light tone to it, which you kind of see in the movie. It does have kind of a light tone, because anytime you watch a movie like this is it's got a very dark kind of maybe almost oppressive tone. And I didn't want that. I wanted this movie to be kind of like the romantic comedy version of Last House on the Left in a way. You know what I mean? So it was like, I wanted it to be like to where horror fans will enjoy it, but anybody else who comes into it will enjoy it too. And I also always had a problem with movies where the guy's the serial killer and they're always like, I'm gonna fucking kill you. And I'm just like fucking angry. It's like, why would anybody be around that person? And I always feel like if you're gonna be a serial killer, you gotta have some amount of charm. Do you know what I mean? So that's why I always tried to make it to where you could see why people would be around these two guys. You know what I mean? And that was an important part of the movie. So you knowing that you're going in with that dynamic, you have to make sure that everyone has the right chemistry. And thankfully, Angelina and Vince and myself, we all liked each other. We all would goof around between shots and have fun. And we had a good chemistry together. And that chemistry comes through the movie. And Angelina, it was one of those things where she got to be able to do stuff no one had given her the chance to do. So she wanted to like really take advantage of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, and another like difference, I think, and this I think maybe helped me, you know, with the feeling of it being from like the 90s, almost like it felt like a 90s movie to me, was like how dialogue heavy it was too.
Yeah,
like you get a lot of independent movies where are, you know, just a lot of horror movies in general where it's about the scary music and jump scares and stuff like that, and it's really not dialogue heavy. And you know, that's the thing, you know, in order to pull it off, to pull off what is there, you know, you need to know what's up. You know, like you need to be able to act and you need to have a good script. And yeah, I mean, very dialogue heavy, but it was written very well. So again, kudos to you on that.
Thank you.
So yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead, Wolfie.
Oh, I was going to ask him about some of the clothes, because I mean, obviously these clothes are 70s. They got to be authentic 70s clothes. There was one of the guys that jumped his character who was wearing a shirt that, Fernando.
Yeah.
He was wearing this shirt that you could definitely, I mean, was this something where you said, hey, let's go down to the local, you know, thrift store and see what we can find that looks 70s or what?
The wardrobe was months and months and months in the making. It was a combination of going to thrift shops. It was and going to like stores that specialized in vintage clothing and going on eBay. And Rich, the guy who I came up with the story with, who played Fernando, he was the guy who was in charge of making sure all the clothing was authentic to that time period. So anything that was in the movie would go through him. And he was there during all the times we went looking for clothes. And he was the one who was always looking on eBay and pointing out stuff to me to go buy and stuff like that. So it was months before we were even shooting that we were just collecting clothes for the movie. And then when we got to the movie, we had a full wardrobe.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's just because I was a 70s child, you know, so it's like I remember seeing all this stuff then.
I remember that shirt.
Yeah. The only thing that was missing in this movie was someone that, I don't know if you guys ever remembered it, but people used to take beer cans mm-hmm. and you know, knit them into bucket hats, you know?
I remember them, but I don't think I ever knew anyone who would wear one.
My brother had one. He had a Budweiser one. So.
That says something. Anyways, so the movies, you know, you were at the ScareCon, and I know you've probably done some other like screenings here and there. It just got released on physical media recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, where can people find it?
It's on DVD and Blu-ray. Like, if you want to get, like, I always look for what the cheapest prices are so people can get the cheapest price. For DVD, that's like, I think, $14 on BestBuy.com. To get the Blu-ray, the cheapest is like $20 on SGL Entertainment's website. They're the company that released it. Okay. And then if you just want to go digitally, on Amazon, you can rent it for 99 cents. Standard definition, or $1.99 for high definition, or you can buy it for I think like $4.99 digitally on Amazon. But I recommend the DVD and Blu-ray because they have loads of extras on them, loads of extras, like a commentary track, like an hour and 10 minute behind the scenes, and like just like a bunch of shit on it. And the other thing I always tell people when you're making this movie, like Angelina, you know, she's a Playboy model, she's used to being naked. And she's naked, handcuffed to a bed for most of the movie. But she, when we were between shots and stuff, she would never put clothes on. So when people would always be like, why wouldn't she put on clothes between shots? Why not? And then people look at the behind the scenes footage that's on the Blu-ray, and they're like, oh no, she never did put on clothes.
So
she was just very comfortable. Right.
You know, so I'm sure.
He's BestBuy.com.
Yeah. Well, you know what that is a great segue into?
What?
Coffee.
Please. Coffee?
Well, if you're new to our show, we got a bunch of people watching. So if you have questions, feel free to post them either in we're streaming live on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, and Twitch. But we have a sponsor. Kevin, who's our sponsor?
That would be Deadly Grounds. I have a cup right here, actually, but it's not filled with coffee because it's too late, and I'm an old man.
It's never too late for coffee, but it's not overly caffeinated. It's just a really good taste. The way he makes it, it's actually really cool. He puts like an oil in the beans as he roasts them, so it's like a hint of like chocolate or chocolate raspberry. Or if you just want regular breakfast blend, they have it. But don't listen to us. Listen to a nice zombie talk about it. Here's the commercial for Deadly Grounds.
Everyone thinks because you're a zombie, you don't know good coffee. Well, they're wrong. There's only one brew that gets my seal of approval. Deadly Grounds coffee is my guilty pleasure. The aroma is so intoxicating. It brings all of my neighbors out of the woodwork. Deadly Grounds coffee. Coffee to die for, and zombie approved. It's good to get a little deadly.
Use the front door!
Oh, they're so disgusting.
Okay, so here we go. Deadly Grounds. Head on to deadlygroundscoffee.com. Also, I believe, getdeadly.com. Show notes. Check the show notes for the link. And I just ordered another 4 bags. They're going to be coming my way. Thanks to CP, I had to get a refill of chocolate raspberry. I haven't had it in about a month. So, Garrow, would you like to introduce the trailer for your movie?
Okay. This is the trailer for Dangerous People. It runs, I think, about an hour. Not an hour. That's the whole movie. It runs about a minute and maybe 20 seconds. I think this is the Green Band trailer, right? You don't want to show the other ones.
Yeah.
They have nudity and gore in it. If you want to see the ones with nudity and gore in it, just go onto YouTube and type in Dangerous People Red Band trailer, and you'll see other trailers that have nudity and gore, but we can't show it here. So this is the Green Band trailer. If you like what you see in the Green Band trailer, go yourself and go search for it on YouTube or Vimeo for the Red Band trailers, and then go rent or buy the movie. So here you go. Dangerous People trailer. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll be right back.
Should have skip step.
Life was so beautiful in the beginning. We'll be right back. was so beautiful in the beginning.
And that was the trailer for Dangerous People. You can pick it up at Best Buy right now for $14.99. I believe we said the price was.
BestBuy.com, right?
BestBuy.com.
Yeah, BestBuy.com. Yep. It's not not in the stores.
No. Also, Amazon, if you want to check it out. And CP.
Yes. So, Gary, you've mentioned two pieces of filmmaking that I think are quite interesting and quite out of reach for a lot of independent filmmakers, the music and wardrobe. How important do you think that is to the film itself? And do you feel that if you weren't able to get that music or that wardrobe, that it would be the same movie, or would you be able to, like, would it alter your process at all?
I wasn't making the movie without the music. It was one of those things where I was going, this movie needs a 70s soundtrack. And going in with such a low-budget movie, I knew that was kind of like a kamikaze mission. You were just destined to blow yourself up and not do anything. But I end up getting lucky. And so I get the music. And the wardrobe isn't that big of a deal. If you know where to look, you know, it can come to you. Like, I think probably I spent maybe about no more than $500, I think, altogether on the wardrobe. It took time to think, but we knew we weren't shooting for months, so we just, you know, ended up getting it along the way. But it definitely the bigger question mark was the music, and I wouldn't have made the movie if I couldn't have the music, because I think the music, the movie and the music coexist together, and without either one, well, I mean, the music coexists without the movie. It did for 40 years. But, you know, I think with the movie needed that music, you know. I had already, once I heard it and I started rewriting the script to actual songs, you know, those songs, it became kind of like, I can't shoot the scene without that music. You know what I mean? It's like, I wouldn't know what to do.
Awesome. I totally, just from a viewer standpoint, I agree. I think the music definitely set the vibe, you know. When CP, when you watch the whole thing, I'm just curious your thoughts too, when, you know, afterwards, because it totally put you in that right mood completely.
Definitely.
It was like the really like the opening credits. The opening credits of the movie are just there to get you into the mood of the movie. Like, there's right. That's the only reason for those opening credits. It's to get you into the mood of what this movie's going to be. You know, if those opening credits weren't what they are, I think it would be kind of like, it'd take a little while longer for the person to get into the film. But once those credits with that music and that kind of like, what's this going on here and all that, I think it gets people into the mood of the film. And it's always important to me with like setting the tone, you know, and you got to set the tone right away with a movie. And that's what I tried to do with this movie within like the opening credits.
It sounds very Scorsese-ish. Whenever I watch a Scorsese movie, the music seems to go hand in hand with it, with those films.
Yeah, music, because this was a 70s movie, the music was so damn important to me and to the movie. That's why when I say I wouldn't make it without the music, I'm 100%, I think, would be making the right decision. Like, this movie lives or dies. Like, it's a good movie as it is, but it's a better movie because of the music.
So if they came to you and said, all right, we can't get this song, but would you mind altering it to this? You wouldn't make the movie.
No, I needed the music that I had. Like, there was, I think, one scene that we didn't end up shooting. It was an opening credit, a different opening credit sequence. The opening credits for the credit sequence for the movie was originally supposed to take place after the opening bar scene. Okay. And it was influenced by Godspell, the movie Godspell. It was a very complicated opening credit scene, and it was going to take a lot of extras and all that, and it's going to take 2 days to shoot. What happened was, I originally had a different cinematographer and different lead actor for the movie, and had about 80% of the movie shot, and then I fired my lead actor and I fired my cinematographer because the movie was really starting to suck because of them. Mm-hmm. So I brought in my original choice for cinematographer, Wheat, who's brilliant, and got me the look I wanted for the movie. And then I had Vince come in, who I was friends with. He came in because I knew Vince was a great actor, because I'd seen him in a bunch of plays and stuff like that. He had a real good range, is what the character Zeus needed. So they came in and I had to reshoot the movie. And basically, I had hardly any money left to finish the movie. So you have to start making sacrifices. So the original opening credit sequence for the movie had to go because it was a two-day, something would take 2 days and money to shoot and all that. And there was a song in there that was an iffy song I could get or not, because when I was working out the deal with J.D. Blackfoot, it had different people who worked on the move writing of the song that would have been paid. So it would have been either harder to get, if at all, or it would have been a more expensive song to get. So when I had to cut that, I ended up coming up with the idea for what the new opening credit sequence would be. And I was able to find a perfect song that he was the only writer of and was able to slip that in there. So there was a point where, yeah, I had to make that, where a song I wanted to use wasn't available, but time and money fixed that for me. You know,
independent filmmaking.
Yeah. Literally, when you're making these movies and you run out of time, money, you start have to pulling out script pages. You know, you go, I want to do this really big. No, I can't do that anymore because, you know, I ran out of time and money. But it's one of those things where you get exactly what you need. And like, I look back at the movie and I go, is there anything I would do differently with it? Film wise, I mean, would I want to go back and reshoot a couple of scenes, maybe make them a little stronger? Yeah, of course. Every filmmaker goes back and goes, I think I can make that better. I can make that better. I can make that better. But is there any scenes I think that are missing from the movie? No, not at all.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. Even though you think you could make a scene better, doesn't mean it has to be better, because it was good enough the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with any filmmaker, they're going to tell you that you don't like feel you're finished with the movie, but at some point you got to walk away from it, because if you don't, you'll just work on it forever. Right. And like, even now, when I remember I was, the film played a few film festivals and I would go watch it at the film festivals, I would sit there in the theater and I'd be watching stuff and I'd be like, oh, that could have been cut. Mm. Oh, that could have been cut. Oh, you know, I could have trimmed that thing. That's a little piece of that line is a little redundant dialogue from there. So it's like, even still I watch it and I go, it could probably be 5 minutes shorter. You know, but yeah, it's already done, so I can't do anything about it. I'm not George Lucas. I'm not going to go in there 20 years later and fix it, you know?
No special edition director's cut?
No. What it is what it is. It's done. It's the movie it is, you know?
Digitally replace the nudity with walkie-talkies or something?
Yeah. I'm sure every guy would love that if I put walkie-talkies over Angelina's boobs. They'd be like, they're hideous. I don't want to see them anymore.
So, you've mentioned, you know, Scorsese. I'm assuming he's an influence. What other directors would you say that you pull influence from?
John Woo. The scene where they walk into the bar and see Erica at the bar was actually me doing my version of the scene from the John Woo movie The Killer, where Chow Yun-Fat walks into the club and sees Sally Ye singing a song right before he shoots the other people in the bar. So that was kind of like me doing my version of that scene. You know, I'm a big fan of Hong Kong cinema, so a lot of my influences are like Stephen Chow and Choi Hark and, you know, and all those type of movies. Because Hong Kong movies in the 90s were very stylish. And I always like, because you would watch American movies in the 90s, they weren't that stylish. You know, they were kind of like almost like made for TV movies that were up there. There wasn't any like, you know, I mean, outside of Scorsese and people like that. But the Hong Kong stuff, like, they would make these comedies that were like if Martin Scorsese made a comedy. You know what I mean? It was fantastic. So I was always inspired by those type of movies. And I've always liked, you know, some horror directors. Like, I always liked Sam Raimi, like his early stuff, like Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Reanimator. I always liked the kind of like dark humor. You know, like, there's a lot of dark humor in this movie. So, you know, it's always that was a huge influence too. But yeah, I've always want to make the best possible movie I can make. So I always like really think through everything that I'm going to shoot to try to make it as visually interesting as possible. And try to make it entertaining for the people, because the last thing people want to do is watch a kind of flat movie, you know?
Yeah. So what else have you worked on besides this one?
We did a movie in 2004 called Actress Apocalypse, which was a mockumentary where I played a no-talent backyard filmmaker. And we had a film crew following us around, documenting our great movie, which was horrible. And the whole thing was actually in the movie, the one who plays the actress who kind of sets things in motion in the movie is an actress named Dahlia LeGault, who's been on like Walking Dead for like the past couple of seasons. So it was weird to be like watching Walking Dead and be like, I know that person. I did a movie with her. But yeah, and it's basically a comedy. It's like 85% a comedy, 15% a horror movie. But it's like my brother is a psychotic person who decides that the documentary that they're making about the movie is the movie, and that every actress we bring in to audition for the movie, he ends up murdering on camera. Hmm. And that's the movie, and the actual movie, not the movie we're making called Clearwater Canyon. That's not the movie. The movie is a documentary that's called Actress Apocalypse. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that.
You might have. It was on Netflix. Back when Netflix used to have independent movies on there, it was on there for like 4 years on Netflix streaming. But yeah, that was the first movie we made. And then we didn't do anything for a couple of years because it was hard to find financing.
Yeah.
And then I found an investor for Dangerous People. We shot that. Rich went off and made another movie called with a bunch of other people called Franklin, A Symphony of Pain, which is available for rent on Amazon, but it never got a physical release. And then now I'm writing something right now, and I hope to be shooting that next winter.
You were talking before we went live that you were somewhat involved with a project with a different kind of funding thing that's going on.
Yeah, my special effects artist, Shiva Rodriguez, she has a short movie she did called The Family Way Coming Home. It's on Amazon Prime if you want to check it out. She's making that's like a kind of short prequel to the main feature she wants to make. And they're doing this thing where, you know, how like most people, when they want to fund a movie, they go on Kickstarter or Indiegogo to raise money by like selling copies of the movies or, you know, T-shirts, mugs, bumper stickers, stuff like that. Well, this is different. They're on a website called WeFunder.com. And basically what you do, instead of putting in money and getting a copy of the movie and different, you know, merchandise things, you invest in the movie. So if you put in like $20, you're investing $20 into the movie and you might see a return on that. Or you put in $100, or you put in $1,000. It's actually you're investing in the movie. So it's the first movie on WeFunder. Because they had to go, because I know they had to go through a lot of regulatory things to get on there. I don't know. I'm not involved in this part of the movie. Like, I'm going to come on, I think, as like a second unit or assistant director or something like that. But yeah, so I know they're doing something new. So if they end up being successful on there, it's something to look into for the future, any future movies I want to make. But the next movie I'm funding out of my own pocket, so I don't have to worry about that. But there, if you're interested, you know, you can check out the short film on Amazon Prime. It's called Coming Home, The Family Way. And if you like it and you think you want to invest in a movie, they're on WeFunder.com.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was looking that up, and that WeFunder is headquartered out of Cambridge, Mass.
Right. Really? Oh, it's not me. I'm not behind it.
Are you sure?
Yeah. It's not a big scam. I'm not here like WeFunder. Yeah. Invest in this movie.
He's like, remember I told you I had funding for my other movie? That's how I got it. Yeah.
There is no movie called Coming Home.
So the big thing is, how do we tie this into Blue Apron? Right?
What are you talking about?
No. Sorry. Bad joke. Remember Lloyd came on.
We're now going to pre-write all your stuff.
It won't help.
No, remember. Never mind.
So was there one movie that you watched that you're like, this is what I want to do? This is I want to start making movies because you watched it, or you always just wanted to make a movie?
Well, at first I wanted to be a film critic. That's what I wanted to be. And I was like, then after a while you're like, why do I want to like be a film critic when I can actually make movies. And then, you know, I've always loved movies as a kid. To me, when a kid, the most important thing was, the thing I loved most was going to the movies. It was like, I can't wait to go to the movies. And as a kid, I was a big comedy nerd. And then when I got into, from comedy, I've gotten into horror, and then the horror, I got into the Hong Kong movies. But I was always a well-rounded film watcher. I'd watch all types of movies except for like Merchant Ivory crap. I wouldn't watch that. But it's like, if it was like an action movie, as an action movies, I'm into comedies, I'm into horror movies, I'm into all that. So, you know, it's, I was always, you know, I always watch movies from all over the world and stuff like that. I used to go to the Toronto Film Festival every year just to go watch movies. So I always enjoyed all types of movies. So my influences are many. Like, that's why I find that Dangerous People is a hard movie to put in a genre box, because I feel it's definitely a bunch of different genres, because I think I'd get bored trying to make a movie that would be easily fit into like a box. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a good thing, though. I mean, it's... You know, it's the more original it is, and more like less, you know, you can't just associate like, oh, it's just like all these other movies. You know,
it's a 70s genre film. Yeah. It's more than just a 70s genre film. It's a, yeah. You know, I mean, I agree. It's nice to be able to, you know, not just throw into one toy box, but a vast many, you know.
It makes it stand out a bit and people remember it.
Yeah, I mean, like the one thing I'm happy about is, like, anyone who watches the first, like, 15, 20 minutes of the movie does not see where it's going in the last third. You know what I mean? It's like, I enjoy that, because I remember when we did the first screening of it, I did, like, a cast and crew screening. The one thing you got to understand, when I made this movie, only a few people saw the full script, like Angelina, Vince, you know, people who were, like, main customers. There were people who came in and had, like, a day, came in and shot. They only knew what their role was. So I had most of the people who came to the cast and crew screening, who brought friends and all that, about 80% of them didn't know what the full movie was, you know, because they never read the full script. So it was cool when you did the first screening to sit down and watch it with people who didn't really only knew what their scene was, to sit down and watch the movie and be like, oh, wait, this is a movie, you know, because they see the trailers. They think it's some like Rob Zombie Devil's Rejects type movie or something like that. And it's not, you know, so it's good fun to watch people kind of sit there and realize what the movie actually is and where it goes. And so that's why I want to keep doing that and kind of keep throwing people curveballs with the movies I make.
Yeah. So you've said that it was playing at some film festivals here and there. In general, how was the the reaction to the screenings?
Always good. People seem to enjoy the movie. You know, it's definitely I've only gotten one negative review for the movie. You know, for all the people who reviewed it, I've gotten one negative one, and I read the guy's review, and I read it, and I said, I'm fine with that, because it was the way he went into the movie. I could see he had his own preconditioned idea of what the movie was going to be, and in the review, you could tell it didn't meet that. Mm-hmm. And that's why he didn't like it. And I was like, okay, I'm okay with that. Like, some people read reviews and they're like, what does this motherfucker mean? How dare he say something like that? And I just sat there and I'm like, I get it. I get why he didn't like it, and I'm okay with it. So I've had one negative review for the movie, and I was perfectly okay with it. Like, it didn't affect me at all. So I was kind of like, if it keeps going this way, I think I'm pretty good. And so far, I have not had anybody be like, your movie sucks. So...
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays. That's a feat.
Yeah. Well, I don't think many people have seen it yet, too. So the more people that see it, the more the chance of people being like, you suck, you're a fag, I hate you. So I'm expecting that at some point. It's going to happen. You know, it's the internet. So
I'll be watching it tomorrow. So hang on.
I'll be expecting that IMDb review any day now.
It's word for word.
I mean,
you just stole my idea.
You know, outside of the music and, you know, the dialogue, the look of the film is what just makes it look so nice. It's got a nice, we've talked about this on here before. It's nice to see that someone knows how to use their equipment, you know, because there's times where people just can't get the point across. And, you know, even if they did take a class on how to do it, but
especially with digital.
Almost at some point in time, it almost could look too glossy for 1970s, you know, and it doesn't come off that way to me.
Yeah, that was mainly because of my cinematographer, Wheat. He's like very talented. And he was the guy I originally wanted, but he was busy. And that's why I went with another person. And that's why I had to fire the other person. But then when we came on, it all went smoothly because it was like we worked very well together. We both knew what we wanted the movie to look like. And like I had bought a fisheye for the movie because all those early 70s movies, they always shot with a fisheye for parts of the movie. So you had to make sure you had a good fisheye lens. So then you have to know when to use the fisheye lens because you can't use it all the time. Yeah. You have to pick the right places to use it. So yeah, it was definitely like I know we had a good time because we definitely went in there with a plan for everything we shot, but we were also left room to be experimental. And the experimental stuff is some of the best stuff in the movie, for looks wise. So that's the way I want to go forward with any movie, is just like leaving enough breathing room to where you can experiment. Hopefully something good comes out of it.
So would you ever think about doing, okay, you did a 70s movie. Would you now next one like go, oh, hey, let's do something in the 80s?
Maybe.
You know, and then the next one do that, you know, like a 90s, but it's not always horror or whatever. I mean, maybe an 80s crime drama, you know, or something.
Well, the movie we were originally going to do before this movie was Rich, who came up with the story with me and worked on this movie with me. He directed Actress Apocalypse. The movie we were going to make before this was, do you know a filmmaker named Tim Ritter? He did like Killing Spree and Truth or Dare.
He did a Bloody Bible Camp.
No. He didn't. No. He didn't do that one. But he did. Sure. He did. Yeah. He was
in
like
that one though.
He might have been. I'm not sure. But he did like a bunch of. He was like the first person making direct to video horror movies in the 80s that went straight to VHS. And one of his first movies was a movie called Killing Spree. And he wrote a script about the making of Killing Spree. And he wrote it, and Rich had rewrote it, and Rich was going to direct it, and it was called Backyard Filmmaker. And that was the movie we were going to do, and it took place in the 80s. And I know Rich was already collecting wardrobe for that. And we were pretty close to shooting that, but then Rich got cold feet on it. And I had all this money to make a movie, and then he was like, why don't you make Dangerous People? But we almost made an 80s movie before we made a 70s movie. And I'm hoping someday we can go back to that because it was a really good script. But
plus you have all the wardrobe just like hanging around now. You just have like a big box of Frankie Says Relax shirts that you need.
Yes.
And I just want to let you guys know that's the second time I've made a Frankie Says Relax joke today.
I know. Oh, today. Oh, wow.
Second time today. Yep.
Wow. Yep. You're on a...
I'm living a dream.
You're on a roll.
So how long did it take you from when you started film? Because I know you said you started and then you had to start all over again. How long did the process take?
We started shooting in 2011, August 2011. It said the film fell apart about a month after that. Then we got it back together by January of 2012. We shot in January, off and on between January, February, March, April of 2012, and then we were pretty much done. Then I came back up to Cambridge. It took me a while to edit it because I had a lot of stuff in the movie that I shot that I didn't know where it was going in the movie, because I would always feel like, oh, I think we need to shoot this, we need to shoot that. It was a lot of the like more surreal stuff in the movie. So I had to figure out the movie and editing, and I'd never edited a movie before, so I was learning how to edit and all that. So it took me a while to edit, and then we had it pretty much figured out by 2015. I went down to Florida. We shot two new scenes for the movie, and then we pretty much had it finished in 2015, and we did a screening of it. And then I came back up to Boston. I found out I had cancer, so I had to get an operation, have cancer removed. Then I had to go through chemotherapy, and that knocked me out for about 6 months. And then after that, I ended up going on the festival circuit a bit with the movie. You know, played a bunch of film festivals, and then basically I signed with SGL in July of 2017, and then they released it in December of 2018.
So it's a process.
Yeah, it's a process.
Wow.
Yeah. And you're doing well health wise, right?
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago I went for the you know, every 6 months I got to go for a blood checkup, and it came back perfect. So, you know,
awesome. Good to hear. Yeah. So that's there's a lot going on right there. So that's good that you're doing well health wise, and we'll be able to see more stuff coming from you. So that's awesome.
Yeah. The thing is like I know this one took a long time. You know, and the next one I want it to be like more streamlined. Like our first movie, Actress Apocalypse, we came up with the idea to do it in June of 2004. We started writing it in July of 2004. We started shooting it in August of 2004. We were finished by October 2004. We finished the edit and had it delivered to Crash Cinema by December 2004, and it was on shelves May 2015.
Wow.
And less than a year, it went from a thought to being on shelves. And I'm like, that's kind of what I want the next one to be. I don't want it to be this like years in the making that Dangerous People was. I want it to be much more streamlined. And now that I know how to edit a movie and do it kind of fast, I think it'll be a much easier thing to do because I'm much better, faster at editing now.
Yeah. And when do you think that the new project, you might get going on that?
I'm hoping to start shooting it next winter. I'm still working on it. I like to do a lot of rewrites in the script to kind of like to get it as good as it can be. Because that's why I think a lot of independent filmmakers kind of fuck up is they kind of like write a first draft and then they're shooting that. And they don't go and they don't work on it and work on it and work on it. And me, I'm writing the script up. I'm writing every scene, rewriting every scene until we shoot it. You know, because it can always be better. And I think that's what a lot of filmmakers should be doing is like not running and shooting their first draft and actually work on it a little bit more. Because I see some of these movies and I'm like, script needed a little bit more work. You know what I mean?
So are you gonna act in the next one as well? Or is it something you're just going to be behind the camera?
It depends. I'm still deciding. There's a role in there. If I can get someone to play it, I'll go and I'll just be behind the camera the whole time. If not, I'll play it myself. But yeah, it's 50-50 if I end up acting in this one. But people like my acting, so you know, if it is, so people like it. If not, you know, hey, what can you do? Maybe I'll play a smaller role in the movie. Who knows?
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I can imagine, like, I'm sure it's hard enough to direct a movie, let alone direct it and be acting in it.
I didn't find it that difficult.
No,
I said the same thing during sit down.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I found it kind of easy, you know? I know that, like, some people will go to it and it's very daunting, but if you, like I was telling Wolfie, I said, if you go in there with a good amount of planning, it's not really a big deal, you know? You go in there and you're just like, okay, do all your work beforehand, and then when you just get onto the set, all you have to really worry about is setting up the scene with the other actors.
I guess that's probably why it seems like it would be so difficult, because I don't plan anything.
Yeah, a lot of work. Yeah, and you have to have a good, like I was telling Wolfie, you also have to have a good support system. Like I had good producers in Catherine and Misha, and then like, I got a great cinematographer, Wheat, so I didn't have to worry about did we get the shot or have to go back and look at what we shot, so I could just look at the footage like later on after we were all done. I didn't have to go and, you know, be like, oh, let me see what we just shot, you know, and stuff like that. I knew he was good enough and I could trust him.
That's cool.
So have you always shot on digital?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We never. I would love to shoot on film. It's just budget-wise impossible.
Yeah. Oh, you know? No. Yeah. I just wondered since you said you shot something in 2004, that's right around the, you know, that was around the transition time when digital was really starting to become more mainstream. I just wondered if you might have shot like on 16 or 30 or, you know, 35 or whatever.
No, would love to shoot on film, but I don't think I'll ever get the chance to. So,
maybe,
you know,
someday. Who knows?
You know, you gotta shoot with what you got. You know what I mean? You gotta, and basically those, like we shot with the Canon DSLRs and those things. If you got someone who knows what they're doing, you can get a beautiful picture off of it. Beautiful. But if you got like your friend who just you handed the camera to and they only used it for about 10 minutes, you know, you're going to get something that looks really shitty, you know? And I would have some people be like, oh, I saw some movie shot with those cameras. And they go, I don't think I want to shoot with those cameras. The movies look shitty. And I go, well, look at Dangerous People. And they're like, oh, wow. And I'm like, yeah, you have to have a filmmaker who knows what lenses to use, what settings to have the camera on and all that. I mean, I've had people to say to me, look at Dangerous People. And some people say to me, oh, was that shot on film? And I'm like, no, it wasn't. And they're surprised because it's like, it's because you have a talented cinematographer and you always got to make sure you have someone who knows what they're doing or else your movie's going to look crappy.
Yep. Preach it. We know people with like expensive cameras and it's just like, all right, just read the manual. Come on, guys.
Yep.
Yeah. Go.
Yeah. It's like some people literally, they put on the lens that they got with the camera.
Yep.
And then they just like are like, okay, they don't know how to light, they don't know how to do all, any of that, and then the movie comes out looking like crap, you know. And I've seen movies shot with the same camera we shot with that look way worse. And
I've seen movies that were shot with, like, you know,
a red
better camera than you have.
Yeah. Very, very high end cameras, and I'm like, all right, well, okay, that happened.
Yep.
So yeah, I respect it. That's awesome. And, you know, there's some people that will do amazing things with an iPhone, you know, like there was this one director I saw at a convention. He was walking around with one on like a gimbal thing. I saw the video afterwards. I'm like, it looks beautiful. This is crazy. Like, cause he knows how to, like, you know, get the right angles and, you know, whatever with lighting and everything. I'm like, fantastic.
Yeah. Like what sold me on Wheat was he shot a movie called Cigarette Girl that was shot with a they shot it on those DVX 100As, those standard definition Panasonic cameras. And I know, because I had one of those cameras, we shot part of Icarus Apocalypse with one of those cameras, and I know that, you know, those cameras, you really have to know what you're doing to get like a really like fantastic picture with it. And I saw what Cigarette Girl looked like, and it looked like it was shot on film. And he shot with that. And I saw the setup he put together with the camera. And I was like, damn, this guy's like the MacGyver of cinematographers with what he did with this camera. And so at that point, I was like, I really want to get this guy to shoot my movie. And eventually it all worked out and he shot the movie.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, I know we're wrapping up on the hour mark, but it's, you know, congratulations on the movie. I'm glad I finally got to see the whole thing. I really enjoyed it. I know the guys enjoyed it. Curious what CP thinks of it. So is there any, you know, besides what you have coming out, where can people go to check out your stuff?
You can go find me on Facebook. I'm on there, Gaur Nagosian. Good luck spelling it, but you'll figure it out. And then the Dangerous People page on Facebook. Just go on to Facebook, search Dangerous People, like the page. And then I'm also do a podcast. I'm a reoccurring on it called on the midnightmoviecowboys.com. I'm on like all the Rob Zombie episodes because they know I hate Rob Zombie movies. So I have to go. They make me watch them and review them, and it's torture. And we do the Mad Max movies. And we haven't done Beyond Thunderdome yet, but we're eventually going to get around to it. And one of the good episodes we did recently, we did one of the documentary, The Red Pill. That one I think is a really good episode that people would enjoy.
Nice.
And that's midnightmoviecowboys.com.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I would like to hear your rants on Rob Zombie for sure.
Oh.
I have mixed feelings. Feelings. I respect him. But at the same time too, it's been such a long time since I've really liked something he's done. So
yeah, it was like 31. They were like, okay, we got to do a 31 because everyone liked the Lords of Salem episode that we did. And then we were like, okay, yeah, that'll be really fun. And then we realized we had to watch 31 and we're like, oh God, we have to watch this. And then you start watching it and it's worse than you could ever have imagined because it's literally all of Rob Zombie's worst tendencies compacted into 90 minutes. And it's just terrible.
What are you talking about? A little Mexican Hitler. What are you talking about?
It was,
so that movie, not to go off subject or whatever, but that movie at the opening scene, which some people would say is the best part of the movie, lost me.
Uh-huh.
And it was because of the inconsistencies in it. So he had a blood smear on his face that kept changing position with every shot. And I'm like, you guys, like, isn't there someone there to like check this stuff? And it took me out of it. And then I don't know. Wolfie said multiple times that if Sherry Moon Zombie wasn't married to Rob, she wouldn't have a career.
But, oh, no. I never thought she was that bad of an actress until I saw Lords of Salem. And then I was like, no, she's a really bad actress. You know, I was like, she's really bad. But it's funny, you know, talking about that opening scene from 31. I walked away from that opening scene going, oh, Rob Zombie found his Christoph Waltz. But the bad Christoph Waltz. You know?
Thank you. I actually didn't mind about the first half of Lords of Salem. I didn't hate it.
Uh-huh.
I was just like, oh, then it just turned into a Rob Zombie movie.
The two Rob Zombie movies I liked are Devil's Rejects and Lords of Salem.
Because the
atmosphere of Lords of Salem. Go ahead now.
I've been all my time of going to movies, I've only had two times where the audience was verbally angry at the movie after it ended. One was the William Friedkin movie Bug, and that was only because Lionsgate sold it as a movie about killer bugs, and it wasn't, and the whole audience was pissed it wasn't. It was about crazy-ass white people. And then...
That's exactly what it's about.
And then the other one was Lords of Salem, where the audience was like saying like that was fucking shit. Like walking out of the theater, like just verbally angry. So it was definitely... and I was one of the people who was verbally angry after Lords of Salem. But there were, like, so many, like, bad things in Lords of Salem. Like, there's a scene where Sherry Moon Zombie is, like, getting up in her kitchen, and she turns on a light, and there's, like, one of them ugly-ass naked witch women standing there in the kitchen with her. And you, any other filmmaker would be like, turn the light. You see the thing, then cut to the next scene. No, Rob Zombie limbers on there for about 30 seconds, of just this naked woman and Sherry Moon Zombie being oblivious to the naked witch woman next to her, and just goes about her thing in the kitchen. And I'm like, is this supposed to be a comedy? Or is he just incompetent? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm hoping it's someday, because I've been a fan. I mean, I've liked his music since I was in high school. So it's like I want him to do good.
I mean, we all were kind of excited when, you know, he said he was going to make do films. And then that kind of all died when I saw House of the Thousand Corpses. I remember walking out of that movie and thinking it was terrible.
The first time I saw it, I actually enjoyed it. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, wow, this really doesn't hold up for a second viewing. And then
I remember,
because we were friends with people that are in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it's like, crap.
I remember my girlfriend at the time, we walked out of House of the Thousand Corpses, and I'm like, oh, that was terrible. And she's like, oh, I really liked it. And I should have known at that point, I should have broken up with her then instead of staying with her for another 3 years because she was insane. And I'm like, there's my clue right there.
We've heard that quite a bit from other directors too. Like, I think it was Harrison Smith said that he took a girl to see Sleepaway Camp, and she's just like, oh, that was horrible. If you like that movie, then you're crazy. He's like, all right, well, we're breaking up then.
Yeah, but I've watched all of. I mean, the only movie I'll say of his that I think is halfway decent is Devil's Rejects. I don't think it's a really good movie. I know some people love it, but I think it's the best of the Rob Zombie movies.
Right.
But then he like totally lost me with like Halloween Remake, which was so bad. Some of the writing in that was so bad, I actually felt embarrassed for him while watching it in the theater.
Oh. Well, but then he does Halloween too, so you can't feel embarrassed until you watch that crap.
Oh, you mean the movie? You mean the movie where basically Michael Myers just chokeholds people to death?
I'm talking about the one where Rob Zombie's wife is walking along in a ghostly fog with a white horse for a good portion of the movie.
So I think we pretty much summed up the fact that we're never going to have Rob Zombie on the show. So
or Sherry Moon.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, it's okay. I'm all right with it. But anyways, yeah, we should probably wrap things up.
Yeah, I know CP has to head on out. So I want to let you all know that if you want to learn more about Dangerous People, check out show notes down below or up above where you're watching us today. Also, we dropped a new episode today. I believe it was the Sid Haig episode today on the podcast?
It would have been a double. It would have been Sid Haig and someone else.
Yes.
I think Sid, wasn't Sid only a half hour?
Yes, it was.
Wasn't it R.A.?
Jeremiah Crick. It was Sid and Jeremiah Kipp, or no, Michael Berryman and Jeremiah Sid. Kipp.
Oh, okay.
Run to the roster.
You're good. So head on over to
all the bald people that have been on the show.
Yeah,
head on, Michael Berryman.
Ari Mahalia.
Yeah. Head on over to thedorkening.com. You'll find out more about our podcast. Secret Underground Hideout had a new episode last week, and the Dorkening had a new episode this week. Also, the video game show as well. And, with that, we will kick things over. Garrow, we talked about where people can follow you. We'll hop on over to CP.
Well, I get reviews on YouTube. Go.
Tony.
You can find me on YouTube at Tony Has Nine Fingers, on Twitter, and on Horimino, actually, and on Stardust app. You can also find me on Instagram, Tony's Movies, where I show off the movies behind me.
Yo.
You can find me at boymeetsphone.com. Also, boymeetsphone on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, wherever you're doing your social media. Also, you can follow me at Yo Saint Laurent in here on the Dorkening.
Wolfie, you get two.
You can find me on YouTube, the 13th Wolfman, Twitter at the 13th Wolfman, Tumblr, 13th Wolfman, the Prowl, every Sunday in the Dorkin, every Tuesday on Wicked Horror Show, doing a horror one with Kev. When we're done with that, we do Wicked Horror Reviews. I do another show with CP once a month called American Werewolf and London over on Will I Like It Reviews, and check out my latest mobile movie review.
Take a breath,
Kevin.
A Knuckle on Twitter, Instagram, Knuckle3 on Snapchat. A Sunday on the Dorkening, Tuesday Wicked Horror Show, doing stuff with Wolfie, and that's that. And then shortly after I leave here, I'll be ordering my copy of Dangerous People on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm digital.
I hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. If you want to be part of a future show, you can find us over on YouTube or Facebook, where we broadcast all our episodes multiple times a week live in front of an online audience, where you can interact with us and our guests. Our main show, The Dorkening, is produced live on Sundays at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific. The Wicked Horror Show comes at you Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And the Ultimate Video Game Show zooms in on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. This has been a Dorkening Network production powered by New Media Promotions. You can learn more about our network by heading on over to www.thedorkening.com.